Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. As you probably know by now, NAHU won a tremendous legislative victory with the repeal of the Cadillac tax at the end of 2019. This week, we sit down with Heather Mead from the Alliance to Fight the 40, the coalition that fought for the full repeal of the Cadillac tax for several years. Before we begin, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify. The podcast is distributed on these platforms every Friday and is included in NAHU's weekly member-exclusive health policy newsletter, The Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. At the end of December, Congress passed the fiscal year 2020 spending bill and companion tax extender measure, which included a permanent repeal of three ACA taxes, the medical device tax, the health insurance tax, and the 40% excise tax that became known as the Cadillac tax. The repeal of the Cadillac tax is a monumental victory for brokers and consumers alike. Heather, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your role in the repeal effort?
My name is Heather Mead. I am a partner at Washington Counsel Ernst & Young, and I have had the distinct pleasure of working with NAHU on repealing the Cadillac tax in running a coalition called the Alliance to Fight the 40. We have been waging this battle in Congress, really starting when the law passed, but in earnest, we've been working on this since 2015 when the Alliance started to come together. And I have been working in employee benefits for over a decade and a half now, former ERISA attorney and Hill staffer, and now I spend all of my time trying to move forward legislation that helps consumers and brokers alike.
Our members have heard the term Cadillac tax many, many times by now. But can you remind listeners what exactly the tax was and what sort of impacts the tax would have had if it went into effect?
The Cadillac tax was a little bit of a wolf in sheep's clothing. If we remember all the way back to 2009 and 2010, when they were passing the Affordable Care Act, the Cadillac tax was included in the bill as a way to pay for the coverage expansion in the law. And what they told congressional members at the time was that, look, this little provision is going to only tax ritzy plans of, you know, Goldman Sachs workers and millionaires and billionaires. But it turns out that the devil was in the details. And the way the tax actually worked was it was just a really sneaky way to cap the exclusion on coverage that was provided by an employer. And the way the tax worked was it implemented a 40% excise tax on any health insurance that was over these federally set thresholds. But the way they set it up was really sneaky because it wasn't just the health insurance that was offered. It was the health insurance plus anything else that was offered by the employer, like the wellness plan, any on-site medical centers, your FSA, your HSA, your HRA contributions. All of those things added together can add up very, very quickly. The other thing that it didn't do was it didn't contemplate all of the things that go into making healthcare expensive. So for example, if you have a plan in Alabama and you have the exact same plan in New York, because the thresholds were static, the plan in New York was going to have to pay the tax, but the plan in Alabama might not. Exact same plan, exact same richness, but someone was being taxed and someone wasn't. When you looked at the reasons why some of the plans hit and some of the plans weren't hit, because it was based on premiums, all of the things that drive premiums were also driving whether or not a plan was going to have to pay it. So if everybody in your plan was really healthy and didn't utilize their plan, you were going to have a low-cost plan that was never going to pay the tax. If you had a lot of sick people in your plan, or maybe you had more women or more part-time workers or some more expensive demographic, your plan was going to hit the tax. So at the end of the day, what the Cadillac tax really ended up taxing were plans that were covering older workers, sicker workers, people living in higher cost demographics, rather than actually any sort of rich benefit plan that was being offered by people who drove Cadillacs. So really at the end of the day, it ended up that employers were having to make really drastic and draconian cuts to their plan to try to stay under these federally set levels. one of the other problems with the tax was that it wasn't actually set to healthcare inflation. It was chained to chain CPI, which meant that every year, more and more plans were going to be subject to the Cadillac tax until eventually 100% of health plans would have been taxed, which meant that employers were not allowed to offer plans that could be offered in the exchanges because the employer plans would have hit the Cadillac tax, but the exchange plans wouldn't. So it was a really sneaky way at really kind of capping that exclusion while trying to sell it as sort of a tax on the rich, which at the end of the day, it really wasn't. So I think we're all pretty happy to see this one go.
And to emphasize exactly how many plans were going to be impacted, and to compare it to what Heather was saying about in the beginning when this was being discussed, there was the thought that this was going to only impact a very small number. So the estimate was about 3% of employers were going to end up being hit with this tax, compared to once getting into all the details and looking at exactly how this was going to impact employers, coming to about 47% of employers, if this was going to go into place in 2020, that were going to be impacted. And then, as Heather mentioned, once we put CPI in and start doing that inflation rate, getting up to the point where almost every employer would be hitting that threshold.
Yeah, a lot of, you know, one of the things we heard on the Hill during the process was that, well, everybody will just switch to an HSA plan and we'll all be done with it. But when they actually started to do that analysis, Marcia, you're exactly right. It turns out that within the first 5 years, 76% of HSA eligible plans would have also been subject to it. So it really was going to be an across-the-board tax.
I think there was this stereotype as the ACA was being passed that Goldman Sachs was offering their employees health insurance plans where they got to have massages with swans, and that they were really...
And swim with dolphins every day.
And dolphins as part of your mental health benefit. Mm-hmm. And so I really think they thought they were going after that market because that would sell well with the American public. Even the term Cadillac tax obviously is not a term we would have liked to use for this, but it was to give an idea that there was somehow health insurance plans out there that were better than you, the average American, were getting. And really, this tax was going to hit everyone. And I think the worst thing about this tax, compared to most taxes we see in Washington, is it really had an effect on health care and health insurance before it even came into effect. Mm-hmm. Because, as you know, agents and brokers and others work with employers so long planning out, they had to plan for this tax to come into place. And even as it was delayed, it was still in the window for a lot of employers to have to plan for it. And unfortunately, what we've seen over the last few years when it comes to health insurance is raising deductibles. And I think the number one cause to those raising deductibles were as small and larger employers alike were preparing for the Cadillac tax to come into place. So we've seen deductibles that used to be $100, $200 now in thousands to tens of thousands of dollars. And I think that is a direct result of that Cadillac tax being in place for the last decade and employers preparing for that eventual date.
As we saw employers starting to plan for this, because we did have those delays that came before we had this final repeal, and we saw our employers starting to plan for this, we at NEHU and part of the Alliance to Fight the 40 started meeting with members of the administration and talking about the regulations that were going to go into place if the Cadillac tax were to be implemented. And it was looking at ways that they could try to adjust based on some of the things Heather mentioned earlier, like your geographic location, the gender makeup of your group, and age. And as we were talking about this with the administration, they were really shocked to see some of the data that we brought in from our employers about how they were having to renegotiate their plans and change the type of offerings that they're using. And that, I think, was really an eye-opener both to members of Congress and the administration on exactly how this had so many unintended consequences of being implemented.
It was really interesting early on, sort of the lack of information that government officials had about how this would affect the private healthcare market and just the role of data in disabusing them of some of those notions. I think two of the things that I thought were really interesting from a government perspective early on, we actually saw OPM, which is the government's sort of HR arm, writing a letter to the Obama administration itself saying, hey, you, guess what? Your own HR function needs to tell you that we're not going to be able to recruit and retain government employees because we ourselves are going to be subject to the Cadillac tax. I have never seen the government write itself a letter like that in healthcare. care, you know, at least in the last 20 years on something like that, where they're like, look, this is not going to work for us. What are you doing? The other thing that happened after that, sort of it's 2 years after that in the Obama administration, the Obama administration really were strong supporters of the Cadillac tax, particularly their economists. And after you brought in all of that data showing what plans were actually doing, we actually saw them put out a request for comment where they said, okay, look, we're starting to get this. How would you actually put into place an adjuster that would adjust for gender and age? But not only that, how would you do it for geography? Because I think they had thought, you know, that there was just this uniformity in healthcare costs across the country. Brokers know that's not true. You could have two cities 50 miles apart,
right,
where you have very different cost profiles based on just the hospitals that are located in
even
those two
counties
cities,
side by side,
right next to each other. And so how do you tax people for something that they are not responsible for and have no control over? And so I think that became really sort of challenging for them to think through. And then the second question that they asked and were never able to answer is, how do you adjust for the sickness in your plan? You know, you had stories, Chris, that your brokers were bringing to the Hill that I thought were really impactful, where they were telling the story of a health plan that had two premature babies. And in year one, they would not have hit the tax. In year two, after those two premature babies were born, they were twins, that they would have their premiums increased to the point, because of that one incidence, that they would have hit the tax. How do you adjust for that? And how is it fair to tax that plan because someone in their plan had two premature babies? They were ready to roll with regulations. You know, I think the dirty secret is that they wrote the regulations. They were on the shelf. They were ready to go. But there were some really significant policy questions that were raised about the role of taxing health plans on their premiums and what that would have done to the health sector overall.
Overall, I think, is again, getting back to the victory, according to CBO, we just saved consumers $197 billion. And so I really think that is a huge impact that, at least in my time in NHU, we've not really seen that big of change in healthcare. So the fact that that amount of money is going to be able to go back into healthcare itself, back to consumers, back to employers, and back to agents who work with those employers, I think is a huge change. And I am very hopeful also to see the negative effects that have been happening to healthcare plans stop. I'm hoping to see the deductibles do not continue to rise. You know, we're very supportive of HSA health insurance plans, but it should not be in a situation where people are afraid to have that health insurance plan because of a $10,000 deductible.
Right.
Particularly if you are in a family or an individual who's sick and knows that you're going to hit those sorts of situations, those sorts of plans do not make sense for those sorts of families. And so I think this will give a lot more flexibility to employers as they design their plans. I think particularly those who work in the self-insurance market can really get creative with wellness and other sorts of in-house benefits. We were going to see a lot of clinics and others that self-insurance employers are very involved in have to go away under the Cadillac tax. So I'm hoping that some of the value-based design and other creativity that's really going on in the health insurance market, specifically in the self-insurance market, can really now start to blossom and grow without the fear of this Cadillac tax coming into place.
So the Alliance to Fight the 40, of which NAHU is a longtime member, was undoubtedly instrumental in the repeal effort. What are some of the steps that the Alliance took to make this happen?
I think you actually answered the question in the question. I think one of the things that made this effort so potent was the fact that it was a coalition. And NHU was one of the founding members of the Alliance to Fight the 40 because they saw the long-term potential effects on the market. The Alliance was unique and still is unique in that it brought together an incredibly broad range of stakeholders that were concerned about the effect of the tax on the market. So it wasn't just the typical employer voice or the voice of brokers or insurers. It was really much broader than that. And it brought together labor unions and consumer groups, other healthcare stakeholders. And I think having that breadth of interest made it really unique on the Hill. it also really kept us focused in our, you know, singular purpose. I think one of the things that really gets under my skin when we talk about the Cadillac tax, and, you know, we just talked about how terrible the tax was. And so when I go out and I'm talking to people about it, they were like, of course, this is so terrible. Of course it was going to get repealed. Of course they were going to delay this tax. And that is just not true. You know, we forget, because it's been so long, that when we started, the ACA had just passed, and people were very protective of the ACA, and suggesting any change to the ACA for Democrats was verboten. You could not do it, and it was a conversation that was very difficult to have. For Republicans, it was the same thing, but on the other side. If you were having any conversation that was not about repealing the entire ACA, that was not a conversation they were going to welcome. And so to try and weave this very narrow bipartisan path to that first delay that we achieved together as an alliance was incredibly difficult and really took sort of the breadth of the alliance, but also I think a few unique things that NEHU was really a critical partner in bringing to the table. You know, one of the things that comes to mind for me was the role in bringing in data. The alliance was very data driven. And one of the things that we did was we brought in actual data from brokers and we took it to the Hill. We turned it into beautiful, colorful charts that the 22-year-old staffer on the Hill could look and see, oh my God, so 40% of all of the health plans in my district are going to be subject to the tax. Oh my God, this tax is going to tax all of the women in my district, and boy, are they going to be angry at me. So we really took the data from the health plans and we turned it into a story that they could understand. The other thing, when I was sort of thinking about this podcast this morning, and I was thinking about, you know, how we came together to create this victory, there were two stories that really resonated on the Hill. And, you know, Chris could tell you, we probably told those stories, what, 200 times, 500 times?
Sometimes to the same person, sometimes, yes.
Over and over and over again. And those stories came from NEHU brokers that shared those stories with you, that then became the stories that crystallized the effect of that tax so that people on the Hill could understand the effect it would have on real people. One of the stories was the story of a nonprofit, right? So you're transitioning. It's not a Goldman Sachs, you know, that's being hit. It's a small nonprofit. The nonprofit worked in the substance use disorder area. So it was something that, you know, Congress really cared about. And the average worker there was making in the tens of thousands, not hundreds of millions of dollars. And the effect on their health plan was so dramatic that it made it really understandable for staff on the Hill what effect this tax was going to have on everyday Americans and their health plan, the effect on deductibles, what it would mean to family budgets, and what it would mean to a small nonprofit that was trying to do the right thing. And it was just such a stark contradiction to what they thought they were selling that it really had an impact. And I just think telling that story over and over again, we would not have had that story to share if it hadn't been for a broker coming to DC, being willing to share that story. Look, at the end of the day, the employer was too nervous to share the story themselves. If it hadn't been for that broker, we wouldn't have had that story to share on the Hill.
And I think that's a real good lesson about lobbying overall. Yes, you need the facts and statistics and the numbers to be on your side. But most people make their decisions based on stories and make decisions based on anecdotes and how it impacts real people's lives. So these sorts of personalized stories where you walk someone through a very intimate situation is how actually most people make their decisions, including members of Congress, and how we all make our decisions in the household. So I think the Alliance did a great job of having all the statistics, the facts, and the figures and the research, but also working with agents and brokers who were involved in the Operation Shouts, who worked with us on getting those stories delivered to NEHU, are really that sort of personal detail about the negative impact on real people that was going to have. And real people who have real jobs, not some sort of Goldman Sachs employee, are the sorts of things that I think really motivate a lot of people to move.
And we did so many outreach efforts to our members trying to get these stories, and you all probably remember getting these emails year after year, not only to send us your stories on your meetings with your employer clients and how they're looking at years ahead and how this is going to impact them, but also our request to do those operation shouts. And each time you responded to that, it just got us that much closer to this full repeal. And when we talk about the data, I would be remiss if I didn't mention one member in particular. And we actually ended up giving her the Cadillac Tax Award at Capital Conference a couple of years ago. And that was Carol Taylor. And because she did so much work in actually putting all of that information together and helping to make those charts that you mentioned, Heather. And I know that we were just so grateful for everything that she did. And this should be a proud moment for her as well.
Yes, Carol and others did a great job of really explaining that long-term process that agents are really involved in with an employer. That it's not just a tax that you'll figure out how to pay once it comes into place, that it's really that long-term process. And she really did a great job, and others, of walking me through that calendar of how you plan out 5 years in advance and the sorts of changes you make to a plan now when you're preparing for something that's 5 years down the window. And those are the sorts of things that I think make this tax so different than every other tax in Washington, where sometimes we repeal it at the last minute or even after the last minute and just try to do it retroactively in Congress. This one had an effect going forward, and stories by our agents really helped explain how this tax was drastically different than any other tax we've seen before.
Yeah, Congress's natural resting state is inertia, right? Like, unless there is a cliff, they do not want to act because it is hard for them to act. And particularly in a partisan environment, it's very hard to come up with bipartisan solutions. And to your point, Chris, that you were making, in order to get them to act and to understand that this tax was having an effect on individuals before it even went into effect was very difficult. And it took all of those operation shouts and all of that outreach to convince them and help them understand that it was having an effect now and was not something that we could continue to push out. Those were also critical, I think, in that piece of education in making sure that we achieve those two delays. They didn't have the political ability to do repeal, but each delay was longer than a year because they were starting to get the idea about the effect it was having in the market. And none of that would have happened without the explanation about how the market worked, how insurance worked, and the timeline that was necessary to affect those plans.
We've also had so many members really understand the changing way to communicate with members of Congress through social media. Lots of NAHU members now have Twitter accounts, and they were actively engaged in those members of Congress. And because those members of Congress often have rather millennial people working for them, they are also very used to Twitter. And so in many ways, that social media campaign that our members were involved in are even better ways of communicating from a distance with their members of Congress, because on the other end, those staffers are so used to using Twitter. And so those personalized stories and the Twitter accounts of the Alliance to Fight the 40 and NAHU, but also those personal accounts of our membership really had a very large impact.
I mean, it is part and parcel of how we lobby now. You need to have that social presence and that social engagement. Members are there, and we need to be there too. I think that was the other thing. You know, this wasn't just a lobbying effort where we came together in coalition and went and told our story. It was a much broader effort that included all of the traditional lobbying components and the educational components and the data components. But we also used, you know, some very sophisticated digital communications efforts in order to communicate directly to members and to deliver messages and ways using, you know, digital technology. We used political messages. We did a lot of polling with, you know, different polling organizations, pollsters that worked for members of leadership or were very well known in order to deliver targeted political messages at the right time, and then to take those messages and deliver them through digital mechanisms in places where we knew people would be at the time we knew they would be there. All of those things go together to sort of build that message, and it took a long time and a lot of effort. The other piece where, you know, we really worked with you and your team was on our op-ed outreach. So the fight doesn't just happen in Washington. A lot of the really important work that we did was targeting very intentionally particular members in particular districts because of their ability to move the issue forward. And we really relied on you to help us find brokers in some key states and key districts who would use op-eds in order to target either, you know, a certain politician or a certain political party to get out a particular message that we needed to reinforce. And that was also a really important part of the broader campaign.
I think the Alliance and NAHU did a great job of also hitting the different pieces of the political spectrum. This is not something that could have been done by just activating liberals or activating conservatives. The messages and the communication, the media plan went into conservative radio, into conservative media, went into more progressive organizations with the help of labor unions and others, went through the centrists and others in Congress who like to work bipartisanly, but also trying to alleviate the fears of the deficit hawks and others in this area that this tax was never going to actually bring in the revenue they said it would, because CBO actually predicted that somehow it was going to bring in revenue in salary increases and we were going to all pay, therefore, more income taxes. Those sorts of things, I think the Alliance did great. So did a great job of working everywhere on the spectrum by picking the right message for that particular audience.
I think one of the ways we can measure the success of our joint effort was in the congressional votes. You know, one of the things that I am most proud of that the Alliance was able to achieve together were our floor votes. So we were able to achieve a vote of 90 to 10 in the Senate on a healthcare issue at the height of the ACA repeal and replace debate. I mean, that is an incredible vote. When the House last summer brought the Cadillac tax to the floor for its very first standalone vote, that vote was 419 to 6. Every single stripe of Republican, every single stripe of Democrat voted in favor of repealing that tax. And that's because of the careful messaging that had been done over a very long period of time in order to prepare for that vote. When we looked over at the Senate, we had over that magic 60 number in the Senate, which you need to move a policy vote. We had 63 members. The thing that is remarkable about it, it wasn't 63 Democrats. It wasn't 63 Republicans. It was split down the middle, exactly bipartisan. And you had support from every corner of the caucus. And I think that's just a tremendous compliment to the work that the Alliance did.
And I think it's a great study in bipartisanship, which is something we at NEHU talk about constantly when we're talking about how to get something passed and why it's so important when we have you all here for things like Capitol Conference and other things to meet with both sides of the aisle and to really educate them and to know how to craft that message, which is also something that we've talked quite a lot about, and especially with the Cadillac tax. Because Heather, like you mentioned earlier, when we were first coming out with messaging, and we would go to Republicans that would say, I'm only voting to repeal all of the ACA. I'm not going to vote to repeal part of it. And then Democrats on the other side that would say, I have to maintain the ACA as a whole. And getting that education to bring those folks into the middle and have that bipartisan vote, it's a great study in bipartisanship and how long it can take sometimes to get there, but why it's so important to continue those messages and not give up, and why it was so important that we repeated those messages year after year with everyone.
I know, it gets so tiresome. I was afraid I was going to be doing it into retirement, but I think one of the things that I frequently remind myself of is that the actual average length of time that it takes for people to pass legislation in Washington is 7 years. Most pieces of legislation that are introduced never make it to committee and die shortly after introduction.
I think it's like 10% of bills that make it to committee.
Even get passed.
Yes, yeah.
The 10% make it to committee. Of those that are ever going to be passed, the average is about 7 years. So we actually were faster than average and more bipartisan.
So one thing that our members ask me quite often when we talk about repealing the Cadillac tax, and I know it's going to be on their minds now that it has been repealed, is how does the government fund those programs that they were expecting to use the funds from the Cadillac tax for?
And that is actually a really funny question, because the Cadillac tax itself didn't expressly fund a specific ACA program. The money from the Cadillac tax just went into the general fund. So it could have equally funded a road or a study on the flow of ketchup as it could have, you know, funded anything in the healthcare space.
And I think that's so important, because a lot of people think that it was explicitly to fund the exchanges and the tax credit.
Yeah, this isn't like other programs where there are fees. Like, one of the things I know NAHU members are familiar with is PCORI fees. Those fees specifically fund the Macquarie program, and without those fees, the Macquarie program would not exist. This, however, is drastically different, that it was just going into the general revenue. As you said, it did not affect any of the tax credits, any of the subsidies. The three taxes, the HIT tax and the medical device tax, they all just went into the general revenue. So so those who were concerned about affecting those other individual market programs and things like that, it never was going to have those sorts of effects. And that often was one of the talking points that I think we really had to work very hard on, because I think there was a misconception that these funds were dedicated specifically to the tax credit.
To funding the ACA. And that is not the case. All of those programs come out of the general revenues. And the Cadillac tax itself, while it had an effect on the coverage that individuals receive, it never actually ever raised a cent of revenue for the federal government.
So Heather, now that the tax has been repealed, what's next for you? And is there anything else you want NEHU members to know?
That's a terrific question. I'm excited for the next battles for coverage generally. I think one of the things that the Cadillac tax revealed is that there is still a lot of misinformation out there about particularly employer-provided coverage and private market coverage. And I think we're going to continue to have that debate. There are still a lot of policymakers in Washington, in the administration and on the Hill and off of the Hill, that still think that we should cap the exclusion and haven't learned the lessons of the Cadillac tax. And I still think there is a very big fight to have on protecting the employer-sponsored exclusion and the role of the private market in providing health care. We're going to see that in the presidential debates. We're going to see that in the ACA repeal and replace process that's continuing. And I think that's an area where I want to continue to work to defend the private market and our healthcare system. You know, the other thing that I think is really interesting that we really saw in the Cadillac tax, right, is that it is not the generosity of the health plan that is driving our healthcare prices. Our healthcare plans are just as generous as they are in Europe and in Europe as they are here. But what is different is the prices that we are paying for that coverage. And so I do think we're going to continue to have a very robust debate about what is driving healthcare costs in America and the role of transparency in those costs. And those are sort of three areas where I'm going to continue to focus. And I think all brokers and employers are going to continue to have to work together in the coming years.
And I think the Alliance really has made a legacy, and Heather has been very humble when she talked about the coming together of the different stakeholders in the Alliance to fight the 40. And when we see some of the other coalitions that have formed, not just on some of the taxes, but on some of the other issues, especially employer related and also just private market related, I think many of them have been inspired by the Alliance to fight the 40 to come together and to do that. So it's definitely a lasting legacy beyond just repealing the Cadillac tax. And we look forward to continuing to work with you guys.
The Alliance to Fight the 40 also has a sister name, Protect Our Care, where you were talking about that cap to the employer exclusion. I think the Alliance / Protect Our Care did a great job of fighting back against some proposals out there that were presented by Speaker Ryan that would have capped the employer exclusion. We definitely can see those sorts of ideas come back again. There are those who still believe that there should not be an employer-based healthcare system, that people should just take care of health insurance on their own and it's everyone's individual responsibility. So I think those sorts of things are going to continue to be an important battle out there, explaining why the employer-based healthcare system works, why it's the bedrock of the American healthcare system. And while there are lots of improvement and changes that need to happen to American healthcare, we should not throw the baby out with the bathwater, and that the employer-based healthcare system should be the basis that we make all the changes to the system and keep what works and change what doesn't.
It's now time for the NEHU Healthcare Happy Hour Toast of the Week. Marcy, what are we toasting to this week?
This week, we're toasting to the Alliance to Fight the 40 and all of the stakeholders that were a member of the coalition to help repeal the Cadillac tax.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for the NEHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NEHU's government affairs efforts or to become a member, visit NEHU.org.